I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Are those popular over-the-counter children's cold remedies safe? That's the question a group of prominent pediatricians and public health officials is asking federal regulators because they say these medications should never be given to toddlers, and the Food and Drug Administration has not tested most of these drugs, particularly the newer ones. The New York Times reports the FDA will review these medications. Dr. Michael Shannon is chief of emergency medicine at Children's Hospital in Boston and one of the doctors who signed the petition. And Dr. Shannon, it sounds like the FDA agrees with your concerns to a point, but you know, parents reach for these medications all the time. What's wrong with them?
There's several problems, but probably the most important is we have no evidence that they work. We have products that really are being aggressively marketed for use in children, and they don't work. There is mounting evidence that as much as you give, they're not going to help your child's cough or cold. That would be number one. Number two, there's a cost attached to buying something that's ineffective, and that could be money better spent. And then probably what's most important, and I think what drove the petition, is the fact that these medications can be frankly dangerous, particularly in children less than two. This petition comes at the tail end of a report from CDC just last month that described three deaths in toddlers who were given cough and cold remedies by their parents.
So were these instances where there were health issues or even worse from these medications, was it because that the medicines were not taken according to the recommended dosage?
In some cases, there was a problem of medications being given too frequently. And in some cases, it was that the medications were being given when the child was taking other medications. But I think the fundamental issue here is that when you talk about any medication in any person of any age, that ultimately you have to ask yourself the question, what is the risk-benefit ratio? Mm-hmm. That is the fundamental question that every person should answer before making the decision to take a medication or give a medication to their child. And in the case of these preparations, we're talking about medications that have zero benefit but have genuine risks.
You know, the Consumer Healthcare Products Association is quoted as saying, and that's the association, I should say, that represents the companies that sell these drugs, is quoted as saying that these drugs are safe, they've been approved by the FDA, and millions of people have taken them for years.
I would say there's a kernel of truth to that statement. These drugs have lived in the FDA category known as generally regarded as safe. And they've lived in that category for decades. But the fact of the matter and the purpose of this petition is that they really have not been adequately studied for safety by the FDA for decades. And it's time for the FDA to really conduct the scrutiny that they should if these medications are going to be so available to children.
Now, you know, being a parent, I know what it's like when a child's really sick. You need to feel like you're doing something. What should parents do when their children are sick?
I completely agree, and I'm a parent also, and I think about those sleepless nights when my child coughed or hacked or just wouldn't go to sleep, and I thought something like NyQuil or anything that would relieve my child's discomfort and help them sleep would help me and help my child. But if they don't work and there are hazards attached, then it really is the wrong approach. You truly aren't helping either the child or yourself. We have to live with respiratory viruses, plain and simple.
So are you saying these medications don't work for adults at all either?
Adult preparations tend to have larger doses, larger amounts of these medications, and as you escalate the dose, then you can perhaps find some benefit, but I really would call it modest. But the adult, in fact, may receive some benefit. I think the classic example is NyQuil is a popular brand name. I don't want to single NyQuil, but the medications that contain the same ingredients as NyQuil have in common a fairly high alcohol content, and alcohol is really very good for helping one sleep at night. And they are marketed to adults. So the modest benefits that adults receive from these medications do come from the fact that they are medications in higher doses and they have ingredients that are not necessarily found in children's products.
All right. Dr. Shannon, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Michael Shannon is chief of emergency medicine at Boston's Children's Hospital. The term hooking up has become the popular way of describing what might be happening sexually among young people. It's a vague term that pretty much covers all types of physical contact, and for an increasing number of young women, it often means casual oral sex with a number of random partners. This warning to our listeners now, this conversation is going to be frank. Washington Post reporter Laura Sessions-Stepp has been writing about young people's sex lives for about a decade, and she wanted to understand why hooking up is so common and what young women think about it. So she spent about a year with different groups of young women, and she writes about that in her new book titled Unhooked: How Young Women Pursue Sex, Delay Love, and Lose at Both. Laura Sessions-Stepp joins us from her office at the Washington Post. Welcome.
Thank you.
We should say also that we're joined on the line by 22-year-old Jessica Smith, who's a student at George Washington University and a sex columnist for the university newspaper who helped do some research for your book. Welcome, Jessica.
Hi, thank you so much.
Laura, let's start with you. As we said, it's a vague term, but how do you describe hooking up? And then I'll ask Jessica to do the same.
It's a casually sexual encounter. It can involve anything from kissing to intercourse, and it's deliberately uncommitted. In other words, the reason I call the book Unhooked is that the defining characteristic of the hookup is the ability to unhook or disconnect from a partner at any time.
I completely agree with what Laura said, but I think one of the most interesting things about using the term "we hooked up" in conversation is that usually if you just kissed, you're trying to indicate that you did more without saying it, and if you actually had intercourse, you're trying not to say you went all the way. So usually it's people trying to either inflate or deflate what actually happened.
Mm-hmm. Now, is it, I mean, certainly we've all heard these stories that make many parents very fearful. Is this really the common sort of sexual currency among young people?
Yes, very much so. I consider myself particularly to be a very traditional girl, but when I came to GW, everyone was hooking up. We lived in these co-ed dorms. There were people everywhere. And not only your want for social acceptance, but your own libido at that age just takes over and you end up hooking up a lot more than you would expect. Almost everyone I know.
And do you think it's the deliberate uncommitment there that's the attraction in part?
I think it depends. I think it really depends. I think that some people do it in the hopes of commitment, but maybe fool themselves into thinking they don't want commitment. And sometimes when you're hooking up, you feel so close to the person that it feels like commitment. But then the next morning you can say, oh, no, it was just a hookup.
Hmm. Laura, you say in the book that the need to be connected intimately to others is central to our well-being as food and shelter, and if we don't get that right, we're not going to get anything else right. Did you find that despite the popularity of hooking up, there were many young women who didn't feel very good about it afterward?
I did find that. I also found that there were some young women who didn't hook up, but always felt like they should be hooking up. It was kind of like in the days of dating, back in the day when I was Jessica's age. Not everyone dated in my dorm, but dating was kind of the model for what you wanted to do. Now it seems to be that it's hooking up.
Hmm. Jessica, would you say that this hooking up culture is leading to a lot of bad feelings on the part of young women?
I would definitely agree with that. I have every friend that I have has had a bad experience at one point where they wake up the next morning. You know, the night before is always so exciting. You're out with your girlfriends, you see someone, and because of the hookup culture, it is natural to go home with them or for them to come home with you. But then in the morning when you get up and you want to leave and he won't walk you home, or no, he doesn't want to get breakfast, it's like you feel that same romance and that same pull to that person as you would if you had started dating, as Laura did when she was my age, but you don't have any of the recourse, and you feel silly for wanting it.
Hmm. Would you say that there's somewhat of a game mentality involved here in the whole thing as well? Is that one way to sort of avoid the negative feelings that may follow?
I suppose, but I think hooking up is so much less of a game that has any winners. I mean, when you dated and you played the dating game and, you know, you waited for him to call you and you said no the first time he asked you out, but then yes if he came back, you know, that was a game. Whereas this, I feel like, is kind of sloppy and all over the place and doesn't really have any rules or boundaries.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that dating is more fun.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
You know, playing the game was fun. And I don't think I'm an old fogey by saying that, am I, Jessica?
No, not at all. I wrote this piece for The Hatchet about how, sure, it was fine. If you want to have casual sex, go have it. Enjoy yourselves. We've worked hard for it. But if you don't, you should be able to play the game and you should learn it. And I had a ton of praise and a ton of backlash because people just aren't there anymore.
Laura, you profile some young women in the book, basically women who are at least moderately well-off, well-educated women. Why this group of women?
Well, in a sense, they're sort of the trendsetters. But they weren't all well off. There, a couple of the high school girls I would say are lower income girls who hooked up, but they didn't call it hooking up. What I've found is that their social habits, they go by different names, but they're essentially doing the same thing. And they're much more alike than different now.
One point that I saw in the book that I thought was very interesting, you also say that young women in this group, for the most part, have been told that they can achieve or they can love.
I've heard it a lot from girls. These are very smart girls. This may be the smartest generation ever, I think. Ambitious and talented. And that's what attracted me to them, frankly, because they're the kind of girls I would love my daughters to be if I had daughters. And yet at the same time, I found that in matters of the heart, in matters of their relationships, they were just as insecure as I ever was, and there were no boundaries anymore. You know, back in the day, there were restrictions that I fought against, as did most women I knew, but they at least constrained us somewhat. Now these young women have no boundaries. They have no one to blame it on, and they have to sort of make up the rules as they're going along.
Doesn't every generation do that? Doesn't every generation sort of push the boundaries and push it and make up the rules and rebel against what's there? Is there something different here among this group of young people?
I'd like to ask Jessica, what sort of rules are there on sexual behavior now?
I think that, yes, every generation pushes the envelope, but somehow, from what I've seen in myself and in my girlfriends over the course of my high school and undergraduate experience, we've crossed a line with the drinking. A lot more oral sex than I think I've ever seen, and a lot less regard for that kind of intimacy than I think ever in past generations. And yes, every generation might push the envelope and then pendulum swing back a little bit, but I don't see us turning back. I see girls afraid of the emotions they might encounter if they do go back to just dating instead of this pretty intense hookup culture, instead of addressing how dangerous some of their behavior is. I think that it's not just emotionally upsetting when he doesn't call the next day. You know, who knows what could happen?
Like the risks of assault or sexually transmitted diseases. Well, we're talking with Jessica Smith, a student at George Washington University. Also with us is reporter Laura Sessions-Stepp. When we return, we ask, do parents know about this hookup culture? Stay with us. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. We're talking about the sexual habits of many young women in the U.S., what's called hooking up. Laura Sessions-Stepp is a Washington Post reporter who's written a book on this after she spent a year talking with young women about their sex lives. Jessica Smith, a student at George Washington University, helped Laura conduct research for her book. We're speaking with both of them, and this warning to listeners, we may be too explicit for some ears. Laura, I want to ask you, there was a recent study that said college students are more narcissistic than ever, and that affects their romantic relationships and their outlook on life. What are your thoughts about that?
There's a girl in my book, I called her Julie, and when she was 14, she broke up with her boyfriend. Her mother walked through. She said, "What, Julie, what's wrong with you?" Julie said, "I broke up with my boyfriend." The mother said, "Oh, at your age, guys don't matter." Fast forward 7 years later, she's talking to me at a party. And I said, "Well, have you had a boyfriend in college?" She said, "Oh, no, college is all about me, M-E. I don't have time for a we, W-E. I think as parents, and particularly, and I'm probably just as guilty as anyone else, have a 22-year-old son, I mean, we have focused on our kids and not given them enough opportunities to make their own choices and to fail.
What about the parents, Laura? What did you find was happening when you were talking with girls about this culture and about hooking up and dating? Were any of them telling their parents? Were the parents accepting this and saying, this is this generation pushing the envelope like I did? Or was it a secret? How was it? Was there a general way that it was handled at all?
Well, I think definitely the oral sex is a secret. Unless the parents start reading the girls' diaries, which I've heard of, or unless they talk to the friends, mothers. And that's really something I think we need to think about, is how can we as parents have that kind of open relationship where we just ask good questions. I mean, I wish every parent could have a training as a reporter, because as a reporter, you're trained to ask questions in a stone face and not react and not jump up and down and scream, which is every parent's inclination. Also, the other thing I want to really quickly say is that these girls watch their own parents, and they watch their own parents' relationship. They've seen divorce. They've seen mom and dad fight and never make up. They've never seen their parents affectionate with each other. So relationships to them, they said that, you know, marriage doesn't look like a very good deal right now. And so I think we have to be good models as well.
Mm. And marriage, again, isn't in that whole picture of what's successful that young people are being told right now. It's succeed in a professional sense, but not necessarily in a personal sense.
I think marriage is considered almost a cop-out a lot of times. I have a lot of girlfriends from back home who are getting engaged, and all the girls who have moved away, I'm from Georgia, and all the girls who have moved away are kind of like, can you believe, why would she do that? Whereas maybe that is the right decision for her. But one opinion I have about the oral sex phenomenon we were talking about, it's that it's not on women. It's specifically performing oral sex on men, and it's not equal. It's not. It doesn't go the other way. And there's something, I think, fundamentally twisted about that.
Well, right. So what do the women get out of it, then?
I don't know. I mean, I've done it, and I don't know. I think that this book is really important because of that, because girls think, in a way, it is a very simple, empowering act as it's happening, and then you walk away from it, and it's not anymore. And I think that is at the root of the hookup culture and the problems with it.
Have you given up on hooking up then, Jessica? Do you say, I'm not doing this?
I've had a boyfriend for 2 years who I was actually just starting to date when I met Laura.
And boyfriend, this means one-person monogamous relationship.
Monogamous,
just
completely.
Checking. I mean, you know, if there's no dating anymore, I don't know where anything
and
is.
And that's the thing. He came after me in a very traditional way, asked me on a date, and I, very early in our relationship, went to perform oral sex on him because I was used to it. And he said, what are you doing? You don't need to do that.
Yeah, Jessica was a little freaked out by this guy who actually was paying attention to her and treating her well.
Treating me excessively well. And I was like, I think he's a wuss. I mean, really. And Laura was like, Jessica, what is wrong with you? He sounds fabulous. And now we've been together for 2 years. So.
Well, you have some advice in your book for mothers and daughters, Laura. But Jessica, what would your advice be to young women and to parents who are trying to understand what's happening?
I love Laura's concept that you really consistently engage your child, and not in a probing, pushy, I'll read your diary if you don't tell me way, but in a, hey, like, I was there. How are you feeling? How does this feel to you? And obviously, you don't need to know the intricacies of your child's sex life, but you do need to know the basics of who they're interacting with, what they think, what they're watching. I mean, Dawson's Creek, watching that show, these kids, you know, one girl was a complete slut because she was having sex all the time, and another girl was a complete prude because she hadn't had sex yet. And I was like, well, where am I supposed to be? Where do I fall? And because my mother was a very consistent communicator with me, I was able to work those things out in the privacy of my own home before I came to college. And I still had a hard time, but I definitely am not one of the unlucky girls who really fell through the cracks of the hookup culture.
Hmm. What happens when they fall through the cracks?
They end up either in a very unfortunate sexual assault situation that they come away from not feeling that it was sexual assault, but feeling that they messed up, or they end up really, really enamored with someone who barely knows them.
Hmm. And Laura, what would your advice be? You actually conclude the book, as we said, with advice for mothers and daughters. What are some of the things that you think people should be thinking about?
One of the reasons I was able to get close to both the class that Jessica was a part of and the girls in my book was that I shared some of my own experiences. And I think that mothers ought to not be afraid to share both their successes with relationships and their failures. You know, we as older women, we've done a great job in raising our girls to be really good at school, really good at sports, good leadership skills. But our message was incomplete. We need to help them with matters of not only the mind and the body, but the heart. And those are the most, those are some of the hardest conversations we have. But if we look deep in within us and we think about our own relationships and we're willing then when the daughter's ready to hear it, to share some of that, then she'll be more willing to go out and say, you know what, this relationship sucked, but I'm going to try again.
Laura, thank you very much for speaking with us.
I'm delighted to be here.
Laura Sessionstep is a reporter for The Washington Post and author of the new book, Unhooked, How Young Women Pursue Sex, Delay Love, and Lose at Both. And Jessica, thank you as well.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Jessica Smith is a student at George Washington University. She also writes a column for the school paper, The G.W. Hatchet. Next week on Here and Now, we hear from a Texas man who spent 20 years on death row. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Two congressional reports released this week show the U.S. military struggling to meet its mission as it fights wars on two fronts. According to one study, 88% of National Guard units are so poorly equipped that they are rated not ready to respond to domestic disasters. In another assessment, the Pentagon says there's an increased risk the military will not be able to adequately respond to a new crisis at home or abroad. That report on military readiness was made public in a 6-page classified document recently delivered to Congress. Well, joining us is Christine Warmuth. She's a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., where she works on defense strategy, policy, and homeland security. Hello, Christine.
Hi, Deborah. Nice to be with you.
Can you tell us a little bit about this classified report?
Yes. The Chairman's Risk Assessment is a document the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs puts out every year, and it essentially describes what the level of risk is to the ability of the military to execute its war plans. It's not generally meant for the public.
Mm-hmm. But what we do know is that the level of risk in military readiness has basically been upgraded. It was moderate last year, or I guess in 05, and in 06 it was upgraded to having a significant risk. Do you agree with that conclusion?
I do, very much so. I think it's evident from overseas operations that our military is stretched quite thin. We have very severe equipment shortages in some cases. So I think it's a very accurate assessment, and I think it's a good thing that the department went public with the overall assessment.
Mm. What does significant mean, basically? Just those things that you mentioned?
What they're saying is that, in essence, it will take us longer to fight the types of wars that we anticipate, and we will incur more casualties and more fatalities than would be ideal.
Mm. And this assessment was made for 06, and this was before President Bush's troop surge went into effect. So how would that factor into things?
Well, I think the if you were to include the troop surge in the assessment, it would only underscore and add to the level of risk, frankly, because it's going to mean more people are going into the field more quickly, more equipment is going to have to get pulled out of units here in the United States. So it's only going to add to the level of risk.
What do you think this increased risk level means for an average soldier and the average citizen? What should people be thinking about this?
Well, I think what it, in the near term, it means just what the chairman would say to the secretary, which is we can do what we're doing right now in Iraq and Afghanistan, but if we have to go someplace else, if, for example, North Korea were to launch a nuclear weapon and we decided we needed to counter that, it's going to be harder and it's going to take longer and more people are going to get killed. In the immediate near term, I don't think it has a tremendous impact on individual soldiers or on individual Americans back here at home. But where it does have an impact is over the long term. If we don't take steps to address these problems and decrease the level of risk, we could potentially find ourselves in a situation where our military doesn't have the capabilities that it needs to protect our interests overseas and at home.
Hmm. What about people inside the Pentagon? What are they thinking right now in terms of strategy and how U.S. enemies might respond to even a perceived decline in military readiness?
I think there's real concern inside the Pentagon about the state of the military. I think the strategy in terms of sending messages to our adversaries and potential adversaries is to demonstrate that while our ground forces, for example, may be under a lot of strain, our total military still has other ways of achieving its objectives. So, for example, that's why you see deployments of an additional aircraft carrier to the Middle East, or that's why you see fighter jet landings, you know, happening in places as sort of demonstrations of American military power. So I think policymakers inside the Pentagon are thinking about other ways to indicate the strength of the U.S. military.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the effect would be if Congress approves, as is being discussed, a measure that would require any new troops sent to Iraq to be fully equipped and properly rested and trained in between tours and tying that to funding for the war?
Essentially, the effect of that would be to tie the hands to some degree of the Department of Defense, because we don't have enough military soldiers to do everything that we want to do in Iraq and Afghanistan and allow them to have, for example, 2 years at home between every deployment. So if Congress passes a law making that kind of linkage, we will have to cut back on operations somewhere. Or we could, but I don't think Congress would want to do this, go to a full mobilization of the National Guard, which would allow the President and Secretary Gates to reach out to more soldiers. The way he is sending them overseas right now is using a law called the Partial Mobilization Authority. It basically says you can send up to 1 million people in the reserve component overseas, but no more.
Hmm. It might be hard for people to understand that. Why shouldn't soldiers be fully equipped and fully trained?
Well, they absolutely should be fully equipped and fully trained, and the department right now is not sending anyone overseas who is not fully equipped and fully trained. That is why, to the extent that there are equipment shortages, for example, they're here at home. They're with the non-deploying units right now. So I would argue that, frankly, that's something that's probably underrepresented in the risk assessment, because that certainly is something of concern to every American, our ability to protect ourselves here at home. And the fact that the National Guard, for example, doesn't have very much equipment here at home is going to make it a lot harder to respond effectively.
Mm. The military is struggling. Would you say that is the picture?
I would say that there are issues. We do face significant risks. I am particularly concerned about the military's ability to respond to events here at home. The Pentagon has taken steps that I think are very positive to try and start addressing the root causes of this readiness problem, the decision to expand the size of the Army, to expand the size of the Marine Corps, and to ask Congress for considerably more money to fill in these equipment shortages. Those are very good steps that over time should solve this problem. But in the near term, we clearly are facing risks. If something else were to happen in the world, we would be facing a harder road in terms of achieving our objectives as a nation. And if something happens at home, I think it's going to be harder to respond quickly and effectively.
Christine Wormuth is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. And later in the show, we'll hear what 12 Seconds in the Dark sounds like. It's the latest release from Uruguayan singer-songwriter Jorge Drexler. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, a different story about military readiness caught our eye this week. It said two Army combat brigades being rushed to Iraq are skipping their usual training at the Army's top training site in California. Instead, they'll prepare at their home bases. One of them, the 2nd Brigade of the 3rd Infantry Division, based at Fort Stewart, Georgia, returns to Iraq in May for its third combat tour since the war began. Well, Here and Now is regularly spoken with one of the soldiers in that brigade, Sergeant Terry Blogg, who's an infantry squad leader and, in his spare time, a ballet dancer. We thought we'd check in with him again, and he joins us on the line from Georgia. Hello again, Terry.
Hello there.
So we understand that before you deploy for the third time to Iraq, your brigade will not be training at the Army's top training site, the National Training Center at Fort Irwin, California. Does that concern you?
Not in the least. In fact, it's actually quite a relief.
Really? Why is that?
Obviously, it depends who you ask and who you get your information from. But I will tell you, at my level, the training and benefits that you receive at a training center such as the NTC or JRTC, for example, in my opinion, they can be recreated at home station without any loss of training value.
Hmm. I understand that the training center in California has a desert environment and sort of sets up this fake Iraqi village. And you've obviously been now to the real Iraq twice. How do you train properly then for that kind of combat?
Well, you just transplant yourself into any environment. You're not going to be able to realistically create downtown Baghdad. Hygiene and health concerns here stateside really won't allow that. You can't really recreate the endless miles and miles of open sewer and dead animals laying all over the place.
You know, we just heard from an expert, a Pentagon expert, who said that units not being deployed to Iraq don't have the equipment they need. But the units that are going do. Does your unit have enough equipment? So your unit's equipment is set.
Well, I mean, there's always a wish list. You know, you always want more than you actually get. But as far as to actually conduct the missions that we're going to be assigned to do, we have everything we need, and then some.
You were first deployed when the war started. Then you spent a year in Baghdad doing patrols from a large U.S. military base. And it's
right.
My understanding your third deployment may be a little bit different, possibly in the volatile city of Ramadi, and you may be going to a smaller outpost. What do you think about that?
You know, that's really interesting. We get a different rumor every single day. First it was Anbar, then it was Ramadi, then it was Baghdad. So we won't really even know until probably the day before we actually show up. So you just have to be prepared for whatever they throw at you.
Mm-hmm. So what do you do personally to get yourself ready to go?
Well, first of all, I got to get healthy. Unfortunately, I suffered a shoulder injury right before Christmas. So,
and we should say this isn't because of fighting or it's not military-related, your injury.
Totally unrelated.
You were lifting your girlfriend, yes, your ballerina girlfriend in rehearsal?
let's just say it was non-combat related.
Okay.
But assuming that I'm healthy enough to deploy with everybody, which is my intent, personally, all I have to do is make sure that my gear is ready, make sure my will and power of attorney is good to go. That doesn't take that much for me because I've been through this before. But
and you want to go?
Absolutely. Right now I'm scheduled not to go, which does not sit well with me. Not because I want to go, you understand. I mean, nobody wants to go. But I cannot bear the thought of my guys doing the job without me there. And that causes a little friction on the home front, you know, with my girlfriend and, you know, her family and my family. And, you know, everybody's pretty much saying, well, you've got your ticket out of this. You know, why don't you just ride it out? And I cannot do that. I just can't bring myself to do that.
When will you find out if you'll get back on the list?
Probably the day before we leave. Worst case scenario for me is that I'll be delayed probably by about 30, maybe 60 days. But, you know, I could live with that if I have to.
Terry, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure.
Staff Sergeant Terry Blogg is with the 2nd Brigade of the 3rd Infantry Division in Fort Stewart, Georgia. In May, his brigade is being deployed to Iraq for the third time. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now.
Clavo mi remo en el agua. Llevo tu remo en el mío. Creo que he visto una luz al otro lado del río.
It was 2 years ago when singer-songwriter Jorge Drexler's song Al Otro Lado del Rio, The Other Side of the River, was the first foreign language song to win an Academy Award for Best Song from a Film. He wrote the song for the movie The Motorcycle Diaries, but Drexler himself was not invited to perform at the award ceremony. He was passed over for Antonio Banderas and Carlos Santana. Citizens of his native Uruguay were outraged, but they cheered when, instead of giving an acceptance speech, Drexler sang some of the winning song. However he might have been slighted by the Academy, Drexler's career was on the rise. His first American release, the album Echo, received a Grammy nomination. His newest CD is 12 Seconds in the Dark. And here's a little of the title song.
Gira el haz de luz para que se vea desde alta mar. Yo buscaba el rumbo de regreso sin quererlo encontrar.
Jorge Drexler is touring the United States this month, and he joins us on the line. Welcome, Jorge.
Welcome. How are you?
Okay. Well, as we said, it's been 2 years since that Oscar ceremony, and now that you've had a little time to look back on it, would you say that the attention from that ceremony helped your career in the long run?
Yes, I really think so. I actually ended up singing, which was what I wanted to do in the first place. And I didn't feel left aside by the Academy. I felt left aside by the production of the TV show, which is different. I mean, the Academy was really brave and really open-minded to consider a song in a foreign language to be in that place.
Right. Let's talk about your career and the beginning of your career, if we could. You were a doctor, and many members of your family are doctors. How'd you make the change?
It actually didn't happen very abruptly. I started studying music when I was 5 years old, and I started studying medicine when I was 18. So I did both things together for a while. And then when I moved to Spain, I realized that I could make a living on music only, and I just dropped medicine for good.
And I have to ask, when you were a doctor, you were an ear, nose, and throat specialist. So do you think being trained in that way makes you look at singing differently?
Yes, it actually makes you look at singing and hearing differently. I have a very trained ear because I used to work with hearing impaired people, and I would be able to recognize frequencies and the works of many different technologies applied to sound, which later when I got into the studio helped me a lot.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to a song from your new CD. This one is Loneliness, Here Are My Credentials. That's the name in English for it.
Soledad, aquí están mis credenciales. Vengo llamando a tu puerta desde hace un tiempo. Creo que pasaremos juntos temporales. Propongo.
This CD is it's more like a personal turmoil, more than an ecstatic contemplation of the surrounding, like the last CD, Echo. This new CD is more melancholic, it's more introspective, more about feelings than science or poetry.
Why? Why so much longing in this CD?
I personally tend to look at the brighter side of life, like the song of Life of Brian says. But in this record, it happened the opposite. I believed that I was missing information from life just to looking at the sunny side of the road. And according to personal things that happened to me, I was faced with a lot of uncertainty and restlessness and doubt, and I thought that it would be honest to put that in a record instead of trying, you know, after a mediatic boom, trying to make a very happy crossover album with lots of duets.
You have another song on a new CD. We go back to Melancholy here, and it's about infidelity in the information age. Why did you include this song?
Why not? I mean, informatic age has turned the computers into an extension of our minds and our bodies. We've charged those machines so much with memories and communication, incommunication, sadness, beauty, horror, I mean, everything that we have in a human. But it's a very new technology. I mean, there's no secrets. I mean, whoever knows a little bit about computers can crack anything. And I heard so many stories about people receiving the wrong message in the wrong place or in the wrong time or in the wrong cellular phone in the wrong with the wrong name, right, that I had to write that song.
Yo amordisco en un lapso clandestino, tragando aquel dolor que se le atragantaba, sintiendo claramente el riesgo, el desatino de la pendiente aquella en la que se deslizaba. Y en tres semanas que parecieron años, perdió las ganas de dormir y cinco kilos. Y en flashbacks de celos aún siguen llegando las frases que nunca debió haber.
Also on the CD, there's one song in English, High and Dry, by the band Radiohead.
I love that band, and I love singing in English. I started singing in English even before I started singing in Spanish when I was a teenager. And that particular song is beautiful, and I understood it fit completely with the emotional entourage of the record.
You'd kill yourself for recognition, kill yourself to never ever stop. You broke another mirror, you are turning into something you are not. Don't leave me high, don't leave me dry.
I want to end our conversation with another song off your new CD. It's called Sanar, To Heal. Maybe you ended this CD with some healing because there was some darkness throughout the music. I don't know, I'm assuming here. Was that part of the reason?
Yeah, I wanted the CD to end with a little light at the end of the tunnel. And I don't think it's a sad CD. I mean, the message, I mean, the 12 Seconds of Darkness is the period between two lights of a lighthouse where I wrote the record, actually, in Uruguay. And I discovered watching the lighthouse that everybody knows that the lighthouse guides through the light, but you also should know that the lighthouse needs the space between two lights to identify itself. The difference between one lighthouse and another, it's the period between two lights, and that's a period of darkness. So it's very, the whole guiding metaphor of the record is that you can learn from uncertainty, and you should assume uncertainty and doubt sometime and try to learn from that kind of period in your life. I mean, I think it's a positive view of doubt and of fear.
Uruguayan singer-songwriter Jorge Drexler's new CD is 12 Seconds in the Dark. Jorge Drexler, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Nadie nace sabiendo, nace sabiendo que morir también es ley de vida.
For more on Jorge Drexler, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Robin Young will be back on Monday. Have a great weekend, and please join us again, Here and Now.
Tu corazón va a sanar, va a sanar, va a sanar.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio.